He's like, that's not what Islam's about at all, man. Like, Islam is about peace and love and compassion. And I should hate you because you hate me? Is that what you're saying? And I'm like, well, it makes sense to me. And he's like, but I don't. I love you. And I want to see you do well. So that really fucked me up, man. Like everything, like I'm fucked at that point. Like, I don't know where I'm coming or going. I don't know what I believe in or who I am. And I'm right back where I was when I got out of the army.
This is Meredith For Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. I explore the questions people think but don't ask out loud, either because they're taboo or thanks to cultural hypnosis. My mission, and yours if you choose to accept it, is to inspire curiosity by exploring the nuance and paradox of our world. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around.
Hey there, Meredith For Real fans. It's Rachel Bernstein, host of the Indoctrination Podcast, a weekly podcast about protecting yourself from systems of control, where I interview cult survivors, experts, and journalists, like on our recent episode, Survivorship, with India Oxenberg, a Nexium survivor. If you're interested in learning about cults and protecting yourself and loved ones who may be in systems of control, come visit me at Indoctrination, wherever you listen to podcasts. You're listening now to Meredith For Real, the Curious Introvert. Here is your host, Meredith.
Hey, Curiositors, it's me, Meredith. When I was listening to this episode, it gave me goosebumps, which is really saying something because, you know, I was there the first time. Last week, you heard how and why Chris Buckley joined the KKK. This week, he shares what his intervention looked like and the surprising things that helped him untangle his ideologies over the course of 2 years. Chris had a lot to say, and there were even some questions left unanswered. So be sure to follow my podcast Facebook page, which is just Meredith For Real, the Curious Introvert, where I'll post a short video with Chris answering those questions. It'll be up on Tuesday, May 17th, 2022. And like last time, this episode has triggers and more cursing than last time. So if you listen in the office, pop in those earbuds, my friend. As always, a monster thanks to you, my returning listeners. I am so grateful, seriously, that you tune in each week. It means a ton. And if you're new here, welcome. I started this podcast to inspire people to choose curiosity over judgment. There's no specific order to listen to the episodes, except for the two-part ones like this one. And at the end of each episode, I give a sneak peek for next week and offer a next episode suggestion. So have a look around and hit play on whatever grabs your attention. All right, enjoy the show. Welcome back to part two of my discussion with former KKK member Chris Buckley. Chris spent 3 years as an Imperial Nighthawk in the Georgia White Knights until his wife successfully arranged an intervention. And he has since become the co-creator of a de-radicalization program designed specifically with veterans in mind. Chris, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the intervention, because you, I imagine you didn't know that your wife was planning it, and then all of a sudden, what, someone's at your door trying to hug you? Like, how? What does a, you know, KKK intervention even look like?
All right, so we have to set the stage here, right? So, like, my wife is watching me fall further and further into this fucking group, and she's like, she's freaked out. Like, she's giving me the ultimatum. It's me and the kids or the clan. Like, you have to choose. And I'm leaving. I'm going to go stay at my sister's for a while until you can figure shit out. Because she was starting to become targeted. Because people wanted to get to me, so they would target her. So she just took a page out of my book, and out of spite and sheer desperation, one night, she's like, she Googles, she's like, how do I get my loved one out of a hate group?
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I mean, that's like the favorite part of like the story up to this point for everybody. So like, I have to like give you some background on my wife. She is the most amazing woman and just genuine, good-hearted. She's my angel, right? She tells everybody, she's like, Chris gave me my backbone, but in all actuality, she gave me mine. I couldn't live without her. She's my best friend. So I really started to think. So during this time, I'm like, I've got to get sober. I've got to get sober. I've got to get sober. I'm going to die. My kids are going to walk in and catch me dead. And I can't do that to them. So like, I start to struggle with sobriety. So in the meantime, Melissa has reached out to a former, the only former in Google's algorithm that would pop up was Arno Michaelis, who is he was actually one of the founding members of a 90s neo-Nazi group called the Hammerskins. And he was the lead singer of a group called Centurion, which was a white power hate band. So she sends off an email. She's like reading his story, watching videos with him. And she's like, oh my God, this is Chris. Chris has got to meet this guy. So she sends an email, like just in desperation, like, hey, please help me. I don't know what to do. What can I do? And he's like, where are you located? What airport do I need to fly into? I'll come down and I'll meet with him.
Oh, wow.
So I have no knowledge of this, right? So I'm outside in the yard and I was playing catch with my son. Like I was trying to teach him to catch. He's four, right? So we're playing catch with a baseball. And this car, my wife is like, hey, I got to go to the store. CJ's, he needs more Lunchables and, you know, your daughter needs diapers. Because my daughter was like not even a year old. She was like 8 months old. I think nothing of it. She's coming and going all the time. I'm out there trying to teach my son to play catch. And this big black SUV pulls in. And my first instinct is like, ah, fuck, the feds are here. Right? And I got guns. Go to prison, and out unfolds this huge man. Like Arno's like 6 something. I'm 5'8" on a good day. And like he unfolds, he's got this super huge deep voice. And he's like, hey Chris, my name's Arno, and you know, your family's really worried about you. And I was like, who in the fuck are you? Right? Like, hold the fucking phone, buddy. Like, this is my driveway. Right, Georgia has a stand your ground. Oh, hold on, I got something. I'm
right.
I'll be right back, and we can let my family be worried about your well being. Right, so I go in the house and I walk out, and I've got a pistol, and like he just didn't budge. He was like, "We're worried about your sobriety. We're worried about your sobriety." My wife pulls in, and like you know, the initial reaction when you're caught doing something that you don't want to be doing and that you shouldn't be doing, you respond with like anger, like how dare you catch me being a drug addict? Ah, right? Like nobody knows I do drugs. Meanwhile, I've got a TV tore apart in my driveway at fucking 3 a.m. I'm gonna fix it though. But so like I when Arno said those words, like we're worried about your sobriety and your health, I was too. And I remember like the will to fight left me. And I broke for the first time in my life. I broke. And like, I'm getting kind of emotional thinking about it because up until that point, I always had to be the strong one. I always had to carry everybody else's shit. And I never really had time to carry my own. And the drugs, the downers helped me numb everything that I didn't want to feel because I felt too fucking much and I didn't want to feel so much. So heroin and pain pills, they helped me to make that numb to where I didn't feel anything. And when you feel too much, not feeling anything is pretty fucking okay. And then there was times when I would be so fucking numb and I wanted to feel something that I would use the uppers. I would use the meth. I would use the stimulants. And I couldn't do it anymore, man. Like my heart would be fluttering. Like, you know, just pounding off. And I just wanted to fucking be normal. And I remember he was like, I used to be an alcoholic. I spent years as an alcoholic. And we started to form this relationship. Now I'm starting to struggle with addiction and sobriety. I remember I did really good, man. I was doing really fucking good. I was like 3 months sober and I fucking relapsed. And I was like, okay, I didn't call my wife. I didn't tell Melissa. I called Arno. I was like, what the fuck do I do, man? I fucked up again. I'm a piece of shit. I'm not worthy to be a part of my family's life. Like, I just want to fucking die. Like, and I started to realize that my using was my attempt at taking a coward's way out. I wanted to overdose. I wanted to fall asleep and never wake up and rid my family of the burden that I felt that they were imposed with, when really I was the burden to myself. So I catch a drug charge, right? Obviously, that's just inevitable. That has to happen to be a part of a good story. So I didn't call my wife. Obviously, I call Arno, and Arno's like, because my wife told me, she said, if you catch a drug charge, I'm done. I will not be here when you get home. And I just assumed that to be fact. So I called Arno and I was like, I need help. He was like, brother, you're in the best place you can be. I'm not mad at you. I don't hate you. And we're going to get through this. But you have to do what you need to do now. And I need to see you make the attempt for sobriety. I can't fight for your sobriety for you. You have to do that. You can't expect your wife and kids to fight for your fucking sobriety. You have to be the one to go out there and claw for it. Claw for it tooth and nail the way you clawed for the next hit of dope when you ran out. And like, I had to set with that. So I sat in jail for months and months and months, like over a year, waiting to go to court. Waiting to go to court. But that was on my request. I told the judge, I said, Your Honor, when I went for my bond hearing, he was like, $500 bond and we'll schedule a court date. And I was like, Your Honor, I need help. If I leave this courtroom today and I leave this jail, I'm going to go use. And I don't want to use anymore. And he said, all right, I got you, young man. I'm remanding you to custody until the opening of a treatment program.
Wow.
Fucked myself on that one because I sat in jail for over a year waiting on the Daily Report Center, the Daily Report Drug Treatment Center to open up, and it was what saved my life. So I start to work on my sobriety, and I've built a really amazing relationship with Arno at this point.
And so give us a time, like how much time has passed? Is this like a year and a half?
So this is from like 2000 and like, I'm still involved in the movement at this point.
Okay.
Right. But I'm working on sobriety. So this is like early 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm starting to get sober and I'm starting to realize that the only reason that I'm involved with the movement was to fund my use of drugs, which is pretty fucking lame. Right. Like, how fucking, like, that's just fucking stupid. That makes no sense, but it does to an addict, right?
So you had to get a clear head to really see the picture. That plus you were probably like physically, if you're physically in jail for a year, and then Arno came into your life a couple months before that, you know, you are replacing the mentorship and the belonging with this new relationship. Plus you're creating physical distance from the clan and their activities, right?
Exactly. So like, there's like all these theories about like how somebody, you would get somebody out of a cult back in the day. Like, you just went and fucking kidnapped them from the cult and locked them in the fucking bathroom for 2 weeks until they were ready to like not play with the Moonies anymore. Right. Like,
right.
You know, like yeah. there's a guy out there that fucking, like, he used to be a Moonie, and like, that's his whole thing. Like, fucking, like, we gotta physically make you not be a part of the Moonies anymore. But like, no, that's not it. There's a very psychological thing happening. And like, so like, I'll pick back up where I was at. So like, I'm in jail. A year goes by pretty much. And over the course of that year, I'm making friends in jail. Obviously, like, you're around people, you need social interaction. And like, I'm clean this whole time. And like, I started exercising with a couple of black guys that I met in there, and they helped me to like get healthy and put my weight back on, and they didn't expect nothing in return. And like, we became really good friends. I started to try to mentor the other drug addicts that were coming in to help them, like, just plant the seeds for when they did get out and got released. Like, so I started my mentorship, like, while I was in jail. Like, I started mentoring addicts. Arno, you know, comes and gets me and visits the same day I get released from jail and get accepted into the treatment program. And like, we have this really long conversation, and he's like, how do you feel? And I was like, dude, I feel amazing. And like, I actually said to him, and it was funny you brought that up, like, I had to say, I have a sober mind. because I use the expression a lot, without a sober mind, I couldn't have a sober heart. Right. And so we start to like, he starts to inch into the ideology with me. This is like in the beginning, like right at the end of 2015, like right before Christmas. I remember because he come down and he brought the kids Christmas presents and we gave him Christmas presents that we made because like I was still really struggling. Because I got out of the program. So the program lasted from 7 a.m. till 4 p.m. Sometimes you would get out at 2 if you were early. You drug test every other day. You're going through classes. You're going through rehab. Well, I still had a family to take care of. I still had a family to support. So from 5 till 5 the next morning, I worked. I would take a 1-hour nap when I got out of treatment. And then I would sleep for 2 hours before I went back to treatment in the parking lot in my car.
Wow.
I ran on 3 hours of sleep for over a year. And I can't tell you where I found the strength to do that. I can't. Like, could I do it today? No. I shot my wad on that. Like, I don't have it in me to be that fucking headstrong anymore to make it through that program and to stay sober and also provide for my family. My wife was going through a lot of illnesses. Like she was really suffering with health problems and she couldn't work. And I wouldn't ask her. I mean, so I started to see that she was eligible for assistance. She got food stamps. I worked, you know, 11 to 12 hours a night and I would take every overtime shift I could. And I kept the bills paid. And this is the time when I was living in a rat hole. The ceiling was falling in. I could literally see my neighbors upstairs walk past the hole in the ceiling.
Oh my gosh.
It could cast a shadow on the wall. The rats were as big as dogs. I mean, like the roach infestation, and like my kids live there. And there's a movie coming out that my documentary Refuge. You'll see these apartments that I lived in. And, but yeah, so I started to confide in Arno about a lot of things because of this natural organic relationship. And I told him about my molestation and he had some insight. He was like, Chris, I think the reason that you're so against the LGBTQ community is because of who hurt you. And I was like, it's kind of abrasive. I was like, you don't fucking know anything, man. Like that's not why I hate him. That's not why I hate him. And like, I realized that that's exactly why the fuck I hated him. I hated every single member of that community because I felt like they all had a part in my molestation. They were the ones that hurt me. And I felt like if given the chance, they would hurt more children. And I realized that person breached the trust of the relationship. Not me. I wasn't responsible for that. It's his fault. And I started to meet and interact with people of that community. And I found some of the best friends that I would ever have in my life in that community. My children's godmothers are a same-sex couple. I love them. They're my sisters. They mean as much to me as my own beating heart does. And I would go to war behind them women, right?
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals. If trash TV leaves you feeling drained and you want to support creators like yours truly, check out StreamMoco. You can search shows by your mood and even, you know, watch my show, The Curious Introvert. For every $3.99 subscription, they give away $1 for good and support their creators like your girl. Find my affiliate link in the episode description or the bio link in my Instagram account, StreamMoco, the streaming network that gives a damn. Listen, if the last 2 years have given you a chronic eye twitch, you should consider trying medical marijuana. I highly recommend it. See what I did there? There's lots of ways for it to help you. So if you have questions and if you're the least bit curious, Google Empathic Practice Pensacola. It's the most non-intimidating way to get your medical card in Florida. Their in-house doctor and holistic support make them the easy choice. Empathicpractice.us. If you've got backyard barbecue plans for 2022, but mosquitoes are not invited, I recommend InSec. I've been using their pest control service for several years now. They have a certified mosquito identification specialist on staff, and pollinator care is always top of mind. If you live in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give them a call, ensec.net. The UWF Historic Trust. We shoot the show at the Pensacola Museum of History. It not only houses exhibits of lesser-known Pensacola history, it's an event space too. So if you need a unique space in downtown Pensacola for a fundraiser, networking event, or a corporate party, take a look at historicpensacola.org. And if you want to tour one of the 12 museums, get your tickets in person so you can show the agent one of my emails and get $2 off an adult ticket. Get emails by texting REAL to 66866. Now back to the show.
But like, that prompted me to think more, like, what else am I fucking wrong about? Like, what else am I just suffering with that's just a figment of my creation, right? Because a soldier without a war will create his war. Because it's all he knows. So I created this war for myself to fight in, to have a purpose, to be a part of something bigger than me. And I allowed Arno to introduce me to a colleague of mine, Mubin Sheikh. He's Canadian. And like, he was the brunt of my anger when I had this meeting with him, man. And I wanted to know what the fuck. You know, like, it was the first Muslim I've spoken to.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And like, I unleashed so much on Mubin, man, and he responded with compassion.
Wow.
And like that, if I really had to point out the one thing that got me out of the movement, it was people that I hated or claimed to hate giving me compassion instead of feeding my anger and my hatred by saying, punch Nazis in the face, because that fucking works, right? All it does is make the Nazi want to punch you back. And it just creates this cycle of violence,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, like, I start to challenge. I meet Mubin. We word vomit. It's really emotional. He explains the Quran, certain things that I believe that the Quran stated, that as a Muslim, a practicing Muslim who's borderline scholar when it comes to the Muslim faith, he's like, that's not what Islam's about at all, man. Like, Islam is about peace and love and compassion, and I should hate you because you hate me? Is that what you're saying? And I'm like, well, it makes sense to me. And he's like, but I don't. I love you, and I want to see you do well. So that really fucked me up, man. Like everything, like, I'm fucked at that point. Like, I don't know where I'm coming or going. I don't know what I believe in or who I am, and I'm right back where I was when I got out of the army. What do I stand for? And now, like, we live in this society where, like, everybody's a white supremacist. Everybody's an extremist, right? So I got involved with Arno, and I was like, I want to do what you do, man. I want to help me in the future. I want to be the intervention. I want to give back. I want to give that mother back her son. I want to give that husband his wife back. And, sorry.
It's okay.
So Arno introduced me to Miriam Churchill, who is the executive director of Parents for Peace. And I remember he was like, dude, they're a really small organization. There's no money there, but there's a chance for you to give back. And I was like, fuck, man, make the phone call. So Miriam calls me and she's like, you know, Arno's been keeping me updated with your story. And I'd just like to talk to you. So Miriam became like my therapist, like my personal therapist for like the first year that I was involved with Parents for Peace. It was strictly, I'd volunteer. I would set in and listen to calls that involved white nationalists or white supremacists. I would provide my feedback. I would help them to understand the ideology, right? And how it manifests. That took off. So after the first year, Miriam was like, I want to bring you on as an official member of Parents for Peace. And I was like, I was amazed. I was grateful. I'm still grateful to this day, and it's been years, that I got the opportunity to give back. So now I am a full-time staff member, which means this is how I make my living, is by working for Parents for Peace. And I remember when I first got on the payroll, I was like, I've got this idea. She's like, what is it? I was like, I wonder if I was just as addicted to hate and extremism as I was to meth and heroin. And she's like, I mean, maybe. And because nobody could tell me no, or that's impossible because of this, it gave me this burden of now, like, just as in anything with science, when you have a hypothesis and you have an idea and nobody can disprove it, you have the obligation to try to prove it or disprove it. So I completely erased, like, the titles of the list of red flags to substance abuse addiction, red flags to people involved in using, and red flags to people involved in extremism and radicalization and grooming. And I took it to one of the previous substance abuse counselors that I had, and I was like, what are these two lists? She was like, they're substance abuse lists. Warning flag.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm like, no, they're not. Like, this one is the warning list for white supremacy and violent extremism and Islamism and environmentalism and all the other isms, right? And this is the list for drug abuse and substance abuse. She's like, that's really interesting. I was like, what do you make of that? She goes, that's really interesting. And I was like, so you don't fucking know either. Great. So I come home and I'm like, I'm still really involved in my recovery at this point, right? Like, now it's just no big deal. Like, I'm not going to sit back and be like, I'm a recovering addict. Now, fuck that, man. Like, you don't hear people that, you know, that beat cancer be like, I'm a recovering cancer survivor. No, fuck that. I beat that shit and I claim it, because I feel like if I continue to be like, well, I'm in recovery, then I allow that cognitive opening or subliminal opening for using again in the future. I've beat my addiction, mm-hmm. right? But I was reading a book at the time by Russell Brand, right? I love that man. He is amazing. And his insight to addiction and recovery is unparalleled. He should be a leading fucking contributor, like the expert on addiction in the U.S. So I'm reading it, and he's like, I remember he made a statement. He was like, the 12 steps can be any fucking thing you want them to be. Basic reason to the 12 steps are, I'm fucked up and I don't want to be fucked up anymore. Why am I fucked up? What can I do to not be fucked up? And that language was so powerful to me, because all I had ever experienced was the 12 traditions, the 12 rules, the 12 steps. And it's like, fuck that. Throw that out the window. I'm going to create a program to help people deal with extremism and ideology the same way we deal with fucking substance abuse. It's a moral cognitive approach, right? So I did that, and that was influenced by Russell Brand.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, now we have the TRP. It's called the Trauma and Recovery Program. We have a fully functional program designed specifically for the American warfighter, soldiers and sailors of all branches. We have an obligation as a society, when we bring soldiers home, to integrate them effectively and give them the tools that they need to become the men and women that they were before they left.
Yeah.
And better. Right. So in the process of that, we ended up with a law enforcement one to help the law enforcement that deal with trauma in the job.
Oh, wow. Not,
yeah. So, and that's actually been piloted with Aurora PD in Colorado. The liaison to that was Officer Sammy Wicks at the time. And they loved it, and we're still working on getting that piloted into other police departments across the nation to get the feedback on that. But I'm going to say it. Police officers are very sensitive, and to even think about the idea of bringing a program in to help them deal with ideology that might arise from their job, right? So it's really easy for a white cop that works in an entire black community to form opinions based on his environment that aren't true. Right. So when we start to put this in front of them and people realize that it's their traumas that justify their worldview, we're able to fix that. And we've got some important leads that we're working on to get that in front of some other officers.
That is incredible. Your story is so impactful. And I think that people watching or listening to this will really appreciate your straightforward approach. And I love that you are out there in the community doing this. So just a couple of quick questions before we sign off that people might be curious and I don't want to leave unanswered. You know, in some of these step-by-step programs, there's one of the steps is reconciliation. And I know from other interviews that you've done that there were you and some of your KKK Klansmen did some pretty gnarly things. And so what have you done to reconcile those acts to those individuals and those families?
Oh, man. I think that the work that I'm doing is directly related to my attempt at reconciliation. I want to see white supremacist groups, Islamist groups, I want to see all these extremist groups not exist. The goal is for me to not have a place in this job anymore because this job doesn't exist. So like I'm at war with the ideology and I'm out there every day trying to, you know, pull people out of hate. And, you know, I make amends anywhere I can. And I apologize to anything that I've ever done that has directly or indirectly impacted somebody. And I can give them this promise that I'll spend the rest of my life making amends for that. This isn't something that I do because I enjoy, although that is a part of it. I do enjoy defeating extremist organizations and taking their members and giving them back to their families. But it's also something that I've inherited an obligation to do. It's part of making amends and giving back.
I can see maybe other individuals coming out of mental patterns of extremism and just kind of going on with their day to day, you know, their more peaceful, loving existence, but maybe not purposefully placing themselves in diverse communities. Like they're not going to go to the gay bar with a friend, right? But they're like, but I'm not part of KKK anymore, right?
You're missing out. That's amazing.
So my
point, I love going to the gay bar.
but I just kind of see like you have such a big personality. Maybe somebody who is, you know, listening to you right now and yeah, one out of the KKK, or maybe they are, don't consider themselves racist anymore, but they're like, gosh, that Chris guy, I feel like he's gone overboard. Have you ever received that comment that, geez, Chris, okay, you're not in the KKK anymore. That's great. Congrats. But you're going a little overboard.
No, dude, because you know what I say to that? I mean, like, fuck you. I'm doing what makes me happy. Right? I'm going overboard. I'm not, dude. Like I'm experiencing my best life, and my best life is very diverse and there's beauty in everything. And I spent so much of my life being sheltered away and just only experiencing negativity. They're like, this is my pursuit of happiness. And you know, I mean, who's to judge me for what makes me happy, you know? And with that, I would say you should look at yourself.
Yeah.
And find out what could make you as happy as me. We should go to the gay bar sometime. Come on, out loud.
Last question. I looked up where you live, and it seems like it's a mostly white town. Am I right?
So
like on paper, it said like 93%. And the reason that I just want to make sure that's correct because it.
But out of it, there's only like 1500 people that live in Chickamauga.
I noticed.
Right? Super small.
Yeah.
My area is very, there's a very high, if you look at my regional area, like North Georgia, super high condensation of Guatemalan and Mexican. So like overall, like Hispanic.
Okay.
Is very high. And then the farther, like towards the middle you get, like towards like Marietta and Atlanta, there's a very high concentration of the black population. So, like, I'm in that medium buffer where, like, it's all old people where I live. I'm super lucky. It's like, a very, like, very quiet area. Okay. And I did that for a reason.
Well, the reason that I'm asking, the reason that it's relevant is how, you know, you said you were kind of starting to get your four-year-old at that time into the Klan, and I think you said in another interview, your kids even use the N-word. Undoing that can be really hard, especially you know, like it's the subtle things, right? So how do you help your children maintain a good perspective when you live in an all white Southern town?
Oh man, look, so this is an easy question. I see where you're going with this. I would just let you ask my kids to tell them about, to tell you about their Uncle Kelvon. All right. Like, I mean, there's just like, it doesn't matter where I live. It's the experience that I put them in. Like my kids, we go anywhere we want to, man. Like just because I live in a white area, like I can't control that. Right. I can't control who lives around me. This was where I could afford. Right. Because even though I work for Parents for Peace, I have very low income. When I say I volunteer and barely make my needs, like that's that.
You're saying is you purposefully bring people into your life and you go to other people, you go outside your area, you purposely seek out these opportunities to mingle with other people who are different than you. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that I don't purposely do anything, because when I purposely go out to find like the token black guy, like, oh, that's exactly what white supremacists do, is they have, like, I'm not white supremacist. I got three black friends, right? No, I don't do that. But like, I don't not do anything, right? Like, I'm not afraid to drive through Atlanta at 12 o'clock at night. It's happened with my windows down. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm not scared of people based on their race, color, creed, and my kids aren't either. And like the undoing of the things, my son had just started to get involved and it was a lot easier. My son is like, he just wants to be like his dad. Like I'm his superhero. And like, he's got a piss poor judgment call just like I did. Like to look up to somebody like me is fucking dangerous, man. But like he emulates me. Like the only reason he even wanted to be involved with any of that shit when he was 4 is because dad was there, you know, and he repeats things he hears, corrective exposure and, you know, leading by example, man. Like I don't seek out anybody based on their sexual preference or their race or religion. That would be kind of fucking bigoted of me to be like, oh, I got to have some Hispanic friends now. Let's go to El Pueblorito's and like make friends with the waiter. Yeah. Like, no, that's not how we do things. You meet people, you bond with them, and you just fucking allow people access to your life and you allow yourself to access theirs. And you don't do it with any kind of intentions. It just happens.
Well, I so appreciate you coming on the show. This was amazing. Can you tell people as we wrap up where they can get in touch with Parents for Peace, and if they know someone who is struggling with extremism, how they can get help?
Yeah, so we have a website, and that's www.parents4peace.org. And we also have a national helpline. It's the only non-governmental funded helpline in the United States and Canada, and that is 1-844-49-PEACE.
Awesome.
And and we do provide support to family members who just don't understand how to approach and deal with their extremist relative. We help the extremist themselves. And sometimes I would put this out there. Please don't call us just because your son or daughter is a Republican and you're a Democrat and vice versa. I have had kids call the helpline and be like, my dad's an extremist. And I'm like, oh, wow, what's going on? We do the intake. And they're like, yeah, he's a Trump supporter. And I'm like, that's not an extremist, man. That's a Republican. Like, there's a difference. And that's what I say. We've overused the word so damn much, man, that like, if I put fucking pineapple on a pizza, I'm an extremist, bro. Like, we gotta get away from the wokeism.
Well, thank you, Chris, for sharing your story, and thank you for what you're doing. And I hope that people connect with the organization. So that's a wrap. Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Woo.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to find my podcast page on Facebook, where you'll find a short video with Chris about how exactly he left the White Knights and if they've retaliated at all. And if you've loved a couple episodes of this show, help me let others know by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the Good Pods app. And if you liked this episode, you'll also like the one with the Congolese refugee and the Georgia man who had a change of heart about immigrants, episode 99. Stay tuned next week when I talk with the author of Grandstanding about how to recognize and prevent virtue signaling. Talk to you then.